are you and what are you doing here?
Hi, everybody.
Well, what are we waiting for?
This is fantastic.
Hello, hello, hello.
This will only hurt for 22 minutes.
It's very early. I may have to hurt you. Call me in 5 minutes.
This is something that is treatable. This is something that is fixable.
Hey, this is not a test.
Oh, my God, it's early.
We're open for business on the Amy Beth Arkley Show, weaving together a mosaic of voices from the arts, pop culture, personal growth, and justice. How are you? Yeah, we'll talk about that spigot of propaganda coming out of the White House. All the implications surrounding the current partial federal shutdown, still boggled by the idea that who's getting paid and who's not. Yeah, Congress, executive branch, I'm talking about you. We'll take it on in the cultural cacophony. Inspiration to action, Sean's success story is already in the mailbag as we turn another page on January. And we'll meet an author who's written a compelling memoir, very personal, but also has political and social implications about a hallmark of the American dream that has been undermined for decades. We'll talk about that in just a couple of moments. Love to get you in the mix, too. You're listening live. It is Tuesday, January 8th, 2 p.m. out west, 4 p.m. central, 5 o'clock here in the east. Our number in motion, 347-857-4505. Hey, Twitter's 24/7, so dive in when it works for you. Live or on podcast at AB Writes. And should you find yourself listening live to the broadcast, as more and more folks seem to be doing each show, avail yourself of the entire social media platforms. That includes our Facebook page and the PopNet chat box. So have at us the way that works for you. It's all helmed by our tenacious, talented TCS crew, Trudy and Aurora in the booth, ML at headquarters. Show is brought to you today in part by Audiophile, music, books, podcasts. Go ahead, caress your ears with everything you want to hear from Audiophile. By Panera, the way food should be, now delivered. And by our friends at PopNet, arts, culture, conversation, on air, online. PopNet features select editions of the Amy Beth Arkley Show and those robust roundtables. So let's welcome Linda Gartz to the show. She's the author of this fascinating new memoir. It's called Redline, the memoir of race, change, and fractured community in 1960s Chicago. Linda, welcome to the show. Okay, we're having a little glitch here. Trudy, let's see if we can get her on the phone and work out the problem. And if you can hear us, we can hear you. Hang up and call us back. Otherwise, we'll see what we can do to troubleshoot this, because you're not coming in, that's for sure. Hang in there. Radio without a net, as they say. On the Amy Beth Arkley Show.
Across the lines, who would dare to go under the bridge, over the tracks, separate white from black? Did you sigh, run for your life? Tonight the riot began. Of America, they kill the dream of America. Little black gets assaulted, ain't no reason why. News for the prince's story, racist simplified. Next day starts a riot, knives and guns are drawn. Two black boys get killed, one white boy goes blind. Cross the line, who would dare to go under the bridge, over the tracks, separate white from black? Did you decide, run for your life? Tonight the riot began. Of America, they kill the dream of America. Little black gets assaulted, no one know her name. Lots of people hurt and angry, she's the one to blame. Across the line, who would dare to go under the bridge, over the tracks, separate whites from black?
them and across the lines. On the Amy Beth Arkowy Show, as we try to talk about this issue of redlining with an author who has put together a compelling memoir, part personal, part political. It's called Redlined, a Memoir of Race, Change, and Fractured Community in 1960s Chicago. I hope we have Linda Gartz with us now. Linda, are you there?
I am. I'm sorry we didn't connect earlier.
Oh, so sorry. We thought we had you, but then either you, I wasn't hearing you. I don't know if you were hearing me, but I'm glad you called back.
No,
thank you so much.
Connected, but here I am. I'm so happy to be here.
Here you are. Happy to have you here. And congratulations on this fascinating book. I know you were working on it for quite a while. I should mention you're also an Emmy-winning documentary producer. You wrote this book based on your family's life, and you grew up in the 50s and 60s in Chicago in the West Garfield Park section. Your parents were landlords. During a time they bought their first two-flat, I guess they called it, in 1949, 1950, I guess, and it was a mostly predominantly white neighborhood. Over the years, it became predominantly African-American. Your family stayed. They were lower middle class, I guess, white family, and they stayed. They invested in the neighborhood, and you saw the changes as a child, and some of the things you didn't really realize what were going on because you had that child's imagination and life that we all remember enjoying as a child, and some things you did know about. And then your whole family, you when you were cleaning out your family's home in the 90s, you discovered a trove of all these correspondence, letters, diaries, journals that your parents had kept, and letters they wrote back and forth, and you discovered a lot of personal things about their own lives.
Right.
And fascinating the way you combine the two things. It's interesting because let's talk a little bit first before we get into the whole family story, what redlining is, because this really did sort of has put a dent in the American dream for a lot of people, African Americans and white people as well. Talk about what that practice was about and how it affected your family.
Yeah, sure. Well, redlining was a policy that actually started during the Roosevelt administration. Under Roosevelt, he was trying to jumpstart the housing market because a lot of people's homes were being foreclosed. So they started something called the Homeowners Loan Corporation. And they wanted to make loans more accessible to more people. So what they did was they sent real estate agents and government surveyors around to cities across the country. This was not unique to Chicago. And the banks wanted to know that their money was safe. So they decided that they would color-code neighborhoods by which neighborhoods were the safest for loans. And they used a four color-coded system. The best and the most reliable loans were to be made in neighborhoods colored green. That was a go. Blue was called still desirable, very still good housing. Yellow was an area that was considered to be declining. But red was called hazardous on the maps. And a hazardous neighborhood was one in which no loans were to be given. And there could be a variety of reasons for a neighborhood being hazardous. You know, terrible, the property itself was in very much decline. But for sure, if one African American moved into a community, then no loans at all were to be given to anybody, black or white, in that neighborhood. So what this meant was that blacks were essentially cut out of the housing market. And if an African American moved into a neighborhood, then the property values would fall for whites because no mortgages were available, so they wanted to get out as quickly as possible, and that led to white flight. But then once most of the whites had sold their houses, the properties were sold to African Americans at higher costs, and they were usually sold on contract, which meant that the African Americans never really held any equity in these homes. And instead, they would buy these homes basically on time. And if they missed one payment, even after maybe paying half of the contract, they could be evicted. So that's kind of a very, thumbnail sketch of what happened. But so in our neighborhood in the west side of Chicago, actually, the neighborhood didn't change over the years. The neighborhood changed virtually overnight from all white to all black. It was in a couple of months after the first African-American bought on our block, which was in 1963. Within 2 months, two-thirds of the block was owned by or rented by African-Americans, and within a year, we were among the last whites left. So it was a very rapid process due to a lot of reasons, white flight, block busting. I'm not sure if everyone knows what block busting is, if you want me to go into that or if you want me to go on with something else.
Well, blockbusting, I think, was the idea that realtors or people come in and scare people to to ignite the white flight, I guess, right? Isn't it?
It was race baiting. You would find flyers in your hallway that would say you better get out before it's too late. So they would basically scare whites into selling very cheaply, and then these blockbusters, they were unscrupulous real estate agents. They could just turn around then and sell the houses to African Americans at a much higher rate. So that's kind of a thumbnail sketch of what redlining did to communities, and it was not unique to Chicago. I mean, our story, the story that I write, you could kind of transplant into a lot of neighborhoods around the country and see a similar thing, except that this is unique to our family story.
To your family. Sure. But, I mean, talk about the rigged system that we're always talking about. I mean, this really hurt a lot of people. It hurt the black families and it hurt the white families, too, because, as you said, they were getting undersold and fed a lot of fear. What made your family stay? I mean, that's very interesting, too, because your family, they weren't radical so much in terms of, you know, radically liberal, it doesn't sound like. I hear you laughing because you know that was true. But they wanted to stay for what reason? They just had pride in ownership, or just stubborn? They didn't want to budge? What was the...
Yeah, I think several of the things you said were true. I think, number one, I think they were a little bolder than a lot of people. They weren't easily scared. And they had more of a, well, let's wait and see kind of attitude. You know, a lot of the other white families said, we better get out of here before it's too late, because they knew that the property values could continue to fall. And I think our family kind of just took the attitude, well, let's wait and see what happens. And what was interesting about that decision is that because they stayed, they came to know their African-American neighbors, and that helped dispel the stereotypes that they held and that most whites held, because frankly, at that time, and I think frankly today too, most whites don't really have a chance to get to know African-Americans. They're seen as the other, and stereotypes, especially at that time before the Civil Rights Movement, just is what, you know, led whites to be so fearful of blacks coming into their neighborhoods. They would see black neighborhoods that seemed to be in disrepair, and often this was because of what I explained before, that when there were blacks in a neighborhood, nobody could get a loan. So if your roof was falling down, your house's porch was falling down, you couldn't get a loan to fix it. So these were a lot of things working together that gave whites stereotypical views of blacks. So what happened when my parents stayed is they came to know their African American neighbors, who were really interested in the same thing that whites are interested in when they buy a new house. They wanted better schools for their kids. They wanted a decent neighborhood. And, you know, my mom writes in her diary, I'm not at all unhappy in this changing neighborhood. And she was very frightened in the beginning. When the first African Americans moved on the block, they were both scared. They didn't know what to expect. But they, I think, just had this kind of bold spirit and were willing to see what happened.
Yeah. They were very hardworking, for sure, your parents. Your father had a full-time job that took him away from home. He was what, an insurance adjuster, inspector, something like that?
Well, this was called the National Board of Fire Underwriters. My dad actually had a college degree, but he had been raised by immigrant parents who had made their living by being janitors. So he had been raised in this home where you did, you know, a lot of physical work taking care of property, and property care to him was almost like a noble profession. I mean, this was something that was a noble, good thing to do, and you never let your property, you know, be out of the best possible condition. But he had this college degree, and he worked for the National Board of Fire Underwriters, which sent these engineers around their territory in our area. This went from Texas all the way up to Minnesota. And he inspected cities to see if they were ready for multiple disasters, let's say multiple fires at the same time. So he was away from home a lot. And then at the same time, they had this two flat that they had changed into a rooming house. So my mom was left, you know, managing this. She was the financial manager. She had to take care of like 11 tenants in our one building. And I just grew up thinking this was normal to have, you know, strange people walking through my house and using the same bathroom. And it just seemed like, oh, that's just a normal way to live. But it was much more stressful on my mother, I realize now, having read the letters and diaries, than I realized when I was a child.
Sure. It's funny, when I was reading it, I was like, wow, this is a very unusual way to grow up, but you are used to what you're used to, like you said. To you, it was Well, you were used to having people sharing one bathroom, and you were living in the dining room with your brother and your grandmother at one point. Then you finally got it. They made a little money, so they opened up one of the bedrooms. I mean, you know, it was just fascinating to read and to just have sort of a bird's eye view of how people live, which is just fascinating. And I know it had to be a tough book to write because you have a lot of personal things about your own family dynamics, and particularly your grandmother, who apparently suffered from some serious mental health issues. And how that impacted the family. And some of the things that you say as a kid, you knew certain things were wrong, obviously, because she had certain eruptions and that kind of thing. And I think she was hospitalized for a while or a couple of times. And but you found out more about how it impacted your parents' marriage when you read the letters and the diaries, correct?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's another thing that's important to realize about this book. It's not just an academic book about, you know, redlining. There are lots of wonderful academic books. But this is really the only book that I could find that tells the story of what happens to a neighborhood from the personal point of view of people with boots on the ground who live through it, and not just live through the redlining, but live through their own family traumas as well. And I think that people hopefully will be able to identify with the fact that, you know, this is a family like many families. There's mental illness is not something that has left us. Many people are dealing with family members who have mental illness, and although we have a lot more help today and we have more medications, it still impacts families tremendously. And I think people can find some perhaps understanding in this book to see what really happens to a family when there is no help, when there is no understanding, when society looks down upon families and demonizes them if there is a mentally ill person in the family. And it was very difficult because my mother was caught between a rock and a hard place. We had this very mentally ill woman. She was actually diagnosed as psychotic. She had delusions and heard voices and sometimes attacked my mother. And at the same time, the mental institutions at the time were frighteningly understaffed and often were viewed as dangerous.
Yeah. She did go to a hospital at one point, right?
Yes, I mean, she had to be, a couple of times she had to be hospitalized, and it seemed, as I read through the diaries, what struck me is that it seemed that there was almost a strange coincidence, or did my grandmother have a little bit of control over her demise, you know, when she's spiraled down into these extremely psychotic episodes, because it seemed that every time something good was happening to my mom, then my grandmother would spiral down into a psychotic episode. So just before my mom got married, she spiraled down, and just before my brother was born. And so those were times when she did have to be hospitalized, but then my mother always brought her home again after a short hospitalization.
Yeah, it just showed that the compelling nature of family and connections and difficulties that people go through. Like you said, I think people can relate to it, and it must have been painful because it's so personal on so many levels, and that's what makes it compelling. You're right. It's definitely not an academic read. You do learn a lot about the redlining. You learn a lot about the social upheaval and changes and, of course, the civil rights movement and all kinds of different things through the lens when you were a young child and as you grew older and went to college and while you were in school and your different friendships and so forth. So that's a fascinating way to look at it, too. But I'm sure being so personal, as a writer myself, I know the deeper you dig personally, the harder it is sometimes. How difficult was it for you to marshal the courage to get through it and to actually write it?
Well, it was a journey, and I have to say one of the things that I did do, and for any of the people who are listening who are writers, I mean, it's really important to read a lot of material in the genre in which you want to write. And I read tons of memoirs. I read a lot of books about how to write a memoir. And what came through in so many of those books and so many of the articles I read was that if you're not honest, the reader will be able to tell. And if you're trying to fake something or trying to cover something up, it's not going to work. So that was the hard part. I had to rewrite some sections dozens of times to keep, like you say, to keep digging deeper and deeper, and that was often very painful. And reading my mom's diaries and my dad's, the letters back and forth, was very sad because you could see how these people were madly in love. My mother's diaries of falling in love with my father are absolutely adorable. And then you see this great love just become battered by life and things that were out of their control, really.
Yeah, what a gift, though, to see all that, to have all that material at your fingertips and to be able to read through it and know your parents in a new way, know them when they were younger, know them when they were first falling in love, as you said. So that was the good part. And then the hard part, of course, is to realize that life takes its toll and they had all kinds of things that were undermining their
Well, that is it. That is the gift. It was these letters were like a time machine. I mean, I was like really whisked back in time to these various eras. I mean, from the time when my grandparents kept diaries of coming to America, and you know, I knew my grandparents as 60 somethings who were, you know, kind of, you know, bickering a lot. But when I see my grandfather's letters, you know, saying to his, you know, love in what is today Romania, you know, if you love me, you will come here. And if you don't come here, I know you don't love me. You know, you see them in these passionate ways that you never imagine them when you know them as older people. And same thing with my parents. And I think that was the gift of this, and I hope a gift that I share with others, of being able to look back in time and see what life was like for people in different eras and how they made it through these various eras of the 20th century, from, you know, immigration in 1911 to, you know, World War I, World War II, and then the 40s when my parents were courting and early marriage, and then the 50s and 60s when the racial changes and the riots started occurring across America. I mean, it was really... it was really a gift through time.
Yeah, it's like the epic story of the 20th century. It's amazing. It's
It was.
Did you ever feel like you were going to give up at some point? Because you worked on this for a long time. Was there a point where you said, "I just can't do this," or did you just say, "This is a mission. I really have to finish this. I want to do this. This is important."
Well, you know, I come, as you probably noticed in the book, I come from a very goal-oriented family. And I had made up my mind that I wanted to write a book about this, and there were many times when I wanted to give up, but then I just knew that I would look at myself for the rest of my life and saying, you could have finished that book and you didn't. So I kept coming back to it and back to it in different ways. I joined writers groups. I finally just wrote it from start to finish. If any of your listeners are writers and know about National Novel Writing Month in November, it's called NaNoWriMo.
Yes.
Where you try to write.
Yeah, we know.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we know, yeah.
So I'm
not a
that
fan, but
really
okay.
Done. I mean, done.
Yeah, well,
in the,
yeah.
I had a first full draft that I could start really.
Right.
It still took
me
several years after that to get it done.
It's such a great picture of a lesson in perseverance, because I always tell people, you know, you have to work it, you have to have inspiration, but you have to have discipline, and sometimes you really have to have that persistence and just keep coming back to it. Sometimes, you know, if it's not the right project for you, then maybe it is time to give it up. But obviously for you, this was the right project, because this is your family's life, this is your life, this is your story, and really you're the only one that could tell it.
And you know, my brothers weren't going to tell it. They live in Seattle, and they were not about to, you know, pour through all this stuff. But somehow I became entranced with it, and it took many different routes, too. I mean, it wasn't a straight line from the first time I read the letters to finishing the book. At one point, I was sending these unreadable letters off to a 90-year-old woman in Germany who was the only person I could find who could read this ancient handwriting. And then that was a side trip that I took to find out all about my grandparents' immigration and early lives in America. But that then took me away from the main focus on the book. Eventually I decided this book couldn't be the sprawling family history. It had to focus on something that was meaningful to people today. And I felt that this issue of redlining, because the consequences of redlining are still with us today.
Yes.
I mean, African Americans have about 6 to 7% the wealth that whites do, because they were never able to invest in property. So it really felt to me that of all the scores of stories I could have told based on these thousands of pages of letters and diaries, that was the one that would have the most impact and help people through a family story, through going through one family's lives in a changing neighborhood, to help them understand the impact that redlining has had on this one family, but also on America.
Yeah, well, it's definitely implications for the whole country, but it's fascinating the way that you do it. So I will tell people it's definitely not a dry academic book. It's a personal book, but you will learn a lot about the practice of redlining and its implications, and also you know, the country and all the different, as you said, all the different movements that you went through, the civil rights, you went to college, your feelings and how you changed as a person too and how you grew and broke away from your family and some of their values. And they grew, as you said too, their values changed. Or not their values changed, but their perspective changed, I should say. It's just fascinating that how the evolution.
That was true. I didn't intend it to be a coming-of-age story, but as I was in my writer's group, people kept saying, I want to hear more about you. I wanted to tell my parents' story, my grandparents' story, but it ended up being also a coming-of-age story, which a lot of people think is also good for young people. I mean, a high school age could certainly appreciate this book, and there's a lot of themes in the book, I think, that would appeal to young people and help them understand relationships and mental illness and redlining and racial relationships. So there's a lot, and sexuality, because, you know, I grew up at a time when there was no birth control and abortion was illegal. I mean, this is something young people today really can't kind of wrap their heads around sometimes. The birth control pill had just come out when I was a young teenager. And it was a felony in Massachusetts in 1965 to give a birth control to any unmarried person.
Mm. Wow.
So, I mean, these are things
there are some,
that
there
I think will
there
help
some forces
young
in this country that would like that. They want to roll it back to that, some people. So some young people might start,
yes,
whether they
I
like
know.
It or not, are going to have to realize. Yeah.
Excellent.
yeah, very interesting. And your friendships as a young, your impressions of other kids and your friendships that you formed. I mean, it was well done. And I think you're right. It'll pull people in a lot of ways where it's compelling. And you learn something without even realizing you're learning something. That's a compliment,
by
the way.
that was my hope, is that I wanted this to be a family story, to be a story that people could really sink their teeth into. And I've been told by many people that, you know, that they started reading it thinking, I'm going to read a couple pages, and then they're up till 2 in the morning. So that was kind of nice to hear.
That's a great compliment as a writer, for sure. So now that you finish this book, after spending so much time on it, what is your next? Do you feel like you have another book that you want to write, or you just, you know, this is it, I'm taking the vacation? obviously, you're promoting the book now. But, I mean, if this is such an undertaking, I mean, no, it's sort of, as a writer, when you're done with a book, it's sort of anticlimactic in a way. You're done with it now. What am I doing next? But then you want to gear up for the next, whatever the next thing may be. Are you in another book by now, or thinking about it, or you just said that's enough?
Well, I think one of the things that I think about sometimes is all the material that I had to leave out of this book. I had to cut about 35,000 words to get this down to a typical 80,000 word or about 300-page book. So I have a lot of material that I had really honed and made really good writing, I think, but was just not quite right once I started working with editors for the book. So I think I'd like to put together perhaps a book of essays of these other stories, and just many, many stories of the family that I was not able to tell. The stories from World War II, there's interpersonal stories within the family, I think, that would resonate with readers. So if I'm going to do anything, that's, I think, where I'm thinking of heading at this point. But I am, this was such an undertaking. I do feel like I'm excited to be talking about it, and I hope people read it.
Sure.
I feel that it really does share a lot of information within a very compelling story.
It is compelling. And you have your background as a documentary producer. Have you thought about dramatizing this as a TV series or a movie? I mean, I could see it, like in the old days, they used to have miniseries or some kind of limited series, they call it now. Is that something that you thought about? Or?
Hey, any directors, TV producers out there who are the call. No, I have done, of course, but my work has been mainly in documentaries, which, of course, this would lend itself to. But, of course, all the main characters in the story have passed away, except for me and my brothers, and I would say that I think I've been told by many people they think this would make a very compelling film or series, but that is another project. You know, that would require screenplays and working with directors, and so that is another project though that I am thinking of.
Fantasy casting. We always like to play that game. Who would you like to see in that?
My husband also says he's got some ideas about who should play him. He says he's going to play himself.
I was going to say, who does he have in mind? Are you thinking George Clooney?
You have to have multiple ages in here for the young person.
That's
I don't know
true.
Who would be a good person. That would be a trick.
That's right. That's very fascinating. Yeah. And, of course, you have to, by the time you get it done, then all of a sudden the actor you had in mind probably aged out of it, or that whole thing. But anyway, it's a fascinating read. It really is, and I know it's a big undertaking. Congratulations on it, and I think, as you said, a lot of people will find it a compelling story. Linda Gartz is the author. It's Redlined, a memoir of race, change, and fractured community in 1960s Chicago. Linda, thank you so much. I'm so sorry we had a glitch at the beginning, but I'm glad we reconnected and got you on the show, because I'm sure a lot of people will be interested. Do you have a website that folks can get to get more info, or no?
Yes, absolutely. I have a very robust website. It's at lindagartz.com, and there's lots of information on redlining and about my family and the archives. And all of these materials are going to go to a wonderful research institution here in Chicago called the Newberry Library. So that's very exciting, and you can read about that too. So that lindagartz.com is the place to go. It's G-A-R-T-Z, like zebra. So thank you so much. I'm sorry for the glitch at the beginning too. I don't know exactly what happened, but I'm so glad we connected.
Terrific. And we will post the information to the website when we post the podcast when it becomes available. Thank you so much, Linda. Best of luck.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate being on. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye. Linda Gartz, again, we will post the information for her website. It's lindagartz.com when it becomes available with the podcast. Well, when that becomes available. You know what I mean. Hey, Twitter feed is Baby Rides, phone line 347-857-4505 should you find yourself listening live on Tuesday, January 8th. Facebook page pop in the chat box open, too. Reach out. It is the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show. Right back.
Take me back.
brand new day here in January, staying on the Amy Beth Arcoe Show. We can still celebrate the new year throughout most of the month. I did finally take out my holiday cards and put them away, but you got to celebrate while you can. The snowmen are still up, though. They'll be up for the winter, I guess. Hey, thanks again to Linda Gartz. That fascinating book, Redlined, it's a memoir of race, change, and fractured community in 1960s Chicago. It's a worthy read. It's compelling. It isn't dry at all. I mean, you'll think, oh, my gosh, it's going to be boring. It really isn't. It's very compelling. And you'll learn something while you read it. So check it out. We will give her lindagartz.com. I'll post the link to the website along with the podcast when it becomes available. As we change gears now, lots of folks fuming over this partial Trump shutdown. You know, tonight he's going to be speaking on national TV, I guess, 7 or 8 minutes from the Oval Office, 9 o'clock. Good thing HBO is running the entire Soprano series. I'll be flicking to that. And Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer will have a response, and I think the networks are giving them their 7 or 8 minutes as well. What about the federal workers that have been affected by this? 800,000 strong, not getting paychecks as of this Friday. People are deferring payments on mortgages and a rent, and, you know, they're giving them a letter to say that the shutdown is on. It's ridiculous, and it's sad. Trump's reaction is he can relate to these people, and people will make adjustments. A, how are you relating to these people? Because you screwed over some workers and didn't pay them back in your day? Maybe that's how you can relate, because certainly you can't relate to the fact that people are having to forgo and ration food with their children, having to delay payments on rent and perhaps utility bills, et cetera. I mean, it's just, it's awful. And people will make, what sort of adjustments are we talking about? And why is it when you have a partial shutdown, and I think this is true every time they've had a shutdown, this goes across party lines, by the way, it's not just talking against the Republicans or Trump, why are the Congress not, why are they getting paid? Why is everybody in the executive branch getting paid? I don't understand that. It's funny how those people are always exempt. When they get pay raises all the time, too. It just doesn't make sense to me. It really bothers me, and there are people that are really going to be hurt in a major way. Not everybody, of course. I mean, the truth is, we were talking, and it kind of goes back to our earlier discussion with redlining. I mean, if you have enough money in the bank to a cushion, so to speak, that you can handle it, you can miss a paycheck or two, and you still wouldn't feel it right away. Not that anybody or most people could live without ever getting paid again, but some people have more savings than others, and those that don't and are living paycheck to paycheck really need that money to make those bills. This is not something where you can just say, well, you can just deal with it and dig into your savings. What if you have no savings? It's really an unfair thing. It really is. And these people are being essentially held hostage over something which is not going to to solve a problem that doesn't really exist. We have an immigration issue, and they have to solve it, no doubt about it. But terrorists are not pouring over the southern border in the droves they're claiming. They have these egregious, fallacious figures they're using, like 4,000 people, when it turned out to be 6 people crossing over the southern border with any kind of arrest. It doesn't make any sense. But they're doing it, and he's doing it because he promised wall. That we removed the vow. Now it's wall. It's a little crazy, and I really feel that there are a lot of people that are being hurt unnecessarily, and they're not even solving the problem. So what's going to happen? And then, of course, people will say, well, he'll just stamp his feet, dig his heels in long enough, and have a tantrum, and then the Democrats will look like the bad guys, and Pelosi and company will have to give in just to make him save face. And that may be the case. Let him save face by calling it a win. I would let him call it a win, but still not give him $5 billion to build a wall that isn't going to be built, ever. And by the way, he already broke the promise. He already broke the promise because he said Mexico was going to pay for it, and he tried to spin himself out of control. Today they sent out Pence, the vanilla VP, on network television, and I have to say, Hallie Jackson, MSNBC, NBC White House correspondent, horrible job interviewing him. Horrible, horrible job. No follow-ups, no putting his feet to the fire. Let him off the hook when he spun himself into political mode by, again, putting it on the Democrats and just talking about policy and not answering the questions directly. What are these people supposed to do who are not getting their paychecks? She didn't put a seat to the fire on that one, and I would have just sat there and said, what are you talking about? How are these people going to pay? Not, they understand that this has to get done. Routine with his imaginary letters and the imaginary friends he has in the former presidents, none of whom said they agree with the wall, by the way. He lied about it. He openly lies, doubles down, triples down the lies, and expects people to buy it. What do you think? Twitter is AB Writes, phone line 347-857-4505. Yes, we've got Facebook page open and the PopNet chat box as well. So talking about the workers losing their pay, we have that? We do. Arl says, it's very sad, but now let's talk about the policeman in California who was killed by an illegal alien last week and get his opinion on the wall. Let's talk to that policeman. Yeah, that's sad. It's always sad when you bring up anecdotal situations. The truth is, though, and that is horrible, and it's always horrible when anybody loses their life. It's always horrible when anybody's murdered. But the truth is, if you go by statistics, more native-born people are committing murders than anybody who comes in here illegally. And that's just fact. Again, facts are very inconvenient little things that the Trump administration and the Trumpians who follow him want to ignore. We can't do it. You have to stare them in the face, and I think they should be fact-checked in real time while this so-called speech is going on, by the way. I don't know if the networks are going to do it, but I hope they would. So what's your say about this? Agree with you, so says Nancy, about the pay. Congress, president, and company should not get paid while this shutdown is going on. Why should low-level workers have to bear the brunt? Exactly. TSA agents in the, you know, you talk about security and wanting to preserve security. Well, all these TSA agents are calling out sick because they have to go get money somewhere else, working moonlighting at Target or wherever they can pick up some money. Again, these are people that make not that much money, so they don't have a cushion like Donald Trump to rest on. He can relate. That's absurd. I mean, that's just really, really absurd and insulting, frankly. Just really crazy and not something that should be taken lightly, I don't think. Omar says, stay awake, America. We can't just forget about what this guy did. One-term president, please. Enough is enough, so says Tammy. The Trump shutdown is punishing the American people. Getting the government back open and running must be our top priority. And Mitch McConnell must let the Senate vote on the bipartisan legislation to make it happen. Remember, this was something they already approved of. You know, as Nancy Pelosi said, take a win, accept a win, because this was something that the Republicans already voted on. It's because he's listening to Sean Hannity, Ann Coulter, Rush Limbaugh, and Laura Ingraham, and because they were ticked off, all of a sudden he's got to have the actual, you know, he tries to back off and talks about steel slats, et cetera. It's just ridiculous what he's putting these people through. And by the way, why not just vote to open up the government and still negotiate? And maybe you will get the money for the wall. I don't know. I mean, again, I'm not saying I wouldn't be for it, but keep negotiating. Why do you have to hurt people? What is the point of this? Is where my head is at. What about you? Twitter, AB Writes, phone line 347-857-4505. Hey, the Grammy nominations came out this week, today I think it was, and one of the folks who got nominated, Joan Baez, 78 years old, says she's wrapping up her touring and singing her last, she claims, the album that she just got nominated for, Whistle Down the Wind, in the folk Americana category, is going to be her last one. We'll see. She's wrapping up her farewell tour, of course. But Cher had a couple of those, right? So you never know. She might do a few things. And still an activist. I mean, you got to give these people that are sticking in the trenches all these years the credit. And one of the songs from that album that is just so beautiful, it's called The President Sang Amazing Grace. It's a response. It was written by a woman named Zoe Mulder. And Joan Baez heard the song sung by Zoe on the radio one day and said, I got to find out who sang that because I want to record it for my album, and she did. The President Sang Amazing Grace is a song in response to President Obama and his response to that horrible shooting in Charleston, South Carolina. And I just when you hear the song, I mean, of course, you have Joan Baez and her beautiful voice, and it's a gorgeous song. But you think about the time when we had tragedy, of course, in this country, but you had a president who could console us on a national level with all the right grace notes. Here's Joan Baez on the Amy Bittner Show.
A young man came to a house of prayer. They did not ask what brought him there. He was not friend, he was not kin, but they opened the door and let him in. And for an hour the stranger stayed. He sat with them and he seemed to pray. But then the young man drew a gun and killed 9 people, old and young. In Charleston, in the month of June, the mourners gathered in a room. The president came. to speak some words, and the cameras rolled and the nation heard. But no words could say what must be said, for all the living and the dead. So on that day and in that place, the president sang Amazing Grace. The president sang Amazing Grace. We argued where to lay the blame, on one man's hate or our nation's shame, some sickness of the mind or soul, and how the wounds might be made whole. But no word could say what must be said, for all the living and the dead. So on that day and in that place, president sang Amazing Grace. My president sang Amazing Grace.
Voice. I might have dropped a couple of octaves. Joan Baez on the Abbey Bethurkely Show. The president sang Amazing Grace, found on her now Grammy-nominated folk Americana album, Whistle Down the Wind. Wow. Beautiful song from written by Zoe Mulder. Good stuff, Andy. Perseverance. It will help us get through a lot, including your art. Fall in love with something, and it will keep you young, too. Boy, Joan Baez, for years, going strong. And Linda Gartz, the author of that book, Redlined. How about you? On the Inspiration to Action, Sean's Success Story, we salute Eleanor from Reading, Pennsylvania. She's working on a novel after doing some stories and doing the challenge for several months. Got me the discipline, the focus, and the joy back in the whole process, so thanks. Well, thank you, Eleanor. Keep going, and please keep us posted. Hey, if the Inspiration to Action Challenge has worked for you, I'd love to give you a shout-out. You deserve it. If you need a little creative kick in the keister, as we say, reach out to the website, and I'll give you a primer on the challenge, some other tips and tricks to get you into a more creative and productive feeling this new year. Do it at the website. It's AmyBethArkawy, ArkAwy.com. Easy access via the Twitter feed, indeed. Hey, while you're there, you can peruse my stories, the Eliza Gordon Mysteries, some other goodies up for grabs. Chime in with your guest suggestions, Big Story and Forgotten 45 requests, all one-stop shopping. And, yeah, of course, we have links to all the podcasts. Don't forget to ask for the Amy Beth Hercules Show, where you get your podcast, from the BTR site to Mixcloud to Stitcher to iTunes. You can find it. Select editions, too, on the Arts Radio Network and PopNet. So there we go. We lost a couple of luminaries in the last couple of weeks, including Ray Sawyer, who was the front man for Dr. Hook, originally Dr. Hook and the Medicine Show, later just Dr. Hook, 70s, 80s sensation, and one of the big pursuits. Get that picture on the cover of the Rolling Stone. We say goodbye to Ray at the age of 81. And Daryl Dragon, the captain of Sal Don from Captain Tennille, he passed away last week at the age of 76. Sail on, guys. The music lives on.
I don't believe it. Don't touch me. Hey, Ray. Hey, Sugar. Tell them who we are.
Well, we're big rock singers. We got golden fingers. And we're loved everywhere we go.
That sounds like us.
We sing about beauty and we sing about truth. At $10,000 a show.
Right.
We take all kind of pills to give us all kind of thrills. But the thrill we've never known, it's the thrill that'll get you when you get your picture on the cover of the Rolling Stone.
Rolling Stone.
Wanna see my picture on the cover?
Stone.
Wanna buy 5 copies for my mother?
Yeah.
Wanna see my smiling face on the cover of the Rolling Stone?
That's a very, very good idea.
I got a freaky old lady named a Cocaine Kitty who embroiders on my jeans. I got my poor old gray-haired daddy driving my limousine.
Now it's all designed to blow our minds, but our minds won't really be blown. Like the blow that'll get you when you get your picture on the cover of the Rolling Stone.
Rolling Stone.
Wanna see our pictures on the cover? Wanna buy 5 copies for our mother?
Yeah.
Wanna see my smiling face on the cover of the Rolling Stone?
Little teenage blue-eyed groupies would do anything we say. We got a genuine Indian guru. He's teaching us a better way. We got all the friends that money can buy, so we never have to be alone. And we keep getting richer, but we can't get our picture on the cover of the Rolling Stone.
Rolling Stone.
Wanna see my picture on the cover? Wanna buy 5 copies for my mother? Wanna see my smiling face on the cover of the Rolling Stone? On the cover of the Rolling Stone. Wanna see my picture on the cover?
We ain't on the cover, baby.
Wanna buy 5 copies for my mother?
I ain't kidding you. We will make a beautiful
cover of the Rolling Stone.
Right up front, man. I can see it now.
We'll be on the front smiling, man. Oh.
Don't mess around, you just gotta be strong. Just stop, 'cause I
Sylvia's mother says Sylvia's busy, too busy to come to the phone. Sylvia's mother says Sylvia's trying to start a new life of her own. Sylvia's mother says Sylvia's happy, so why don't you leave us alone? And the operator says 40 cents more for the next 3 minutes, please.
Mrs. Avery, I just gotta talk to her.
I'll only keep her a while. Says Sylvia's packing, she's gone, be leaving today. Sylvia's mother says Sylvia's marrying a fella down Galveston way. Sylvia's mother says, please don't say nothing to make us start crying and stay. And the operator says 40 cents more for the next 3 minutes, please.
Mrs. Avery, I just gotta talk to her.
I'll only keep her a while. Says Sylvia's hurrying, she's catching the 9 o'clock train. Sylvia's mother says, take your umbrella, 'cause Sylvia, it's starting to rain. And Sylvia's mother says, thank you for calling, and sir, won't you call back again? And the operator says 40 cents more for the next 3 minutes, please.
Mrs. Avery, I just gotta talk to her.
I'll only keep her a while.
Remembering icons we lost on the Amy Beth Arkley Show, Sylvia's mother from Dr. Hook, farewell to Ray Sawyer, who passed away at the age of 81, along with his iconic cover of the Rolling Stone, and Daryl Dragon, along with his ex-wife, Tony Tennille, Captain and Tennille, Love Will Keep Us Together, their big mid-70s hit, which also ushered in a new era for singer-songwriter, 50s icon, Neil Sedaka. Sedaka is back, but the music still lives on indeed, and we need music. It makes us feel good, right? What doesn't make us feel good is this nonsense and political machinations around this partial federal government shutdown. We'll see what Trump says today, and we run around the media, social media horn one final time before we sashay out of here. On Twitter, Bob says, warning, if you're going to watch tonight from the Oval Office, it will be a fact-free event. Pauline says, I hate all politicians, but Trump is the absolute worst. How's that draining the swamp thing working for you anyway? Mm-hmm. And Jason on the PopNet chat box says, McConnell in the Senate is now trying to blame the Democrats, but the Democrats have no demands in these negotiations. They want nothing. It is Trump who is throwing a political tantrum, and Mitch McConnell is caught in the middle. The pressure is getting to McConnell, too, and his old game of blaming the Dems won't work this time. There will be no wall and no funding for it, and it is McConnell who Trump will try to blame for his own failure. Let's stay tuned and see what happens there. I don't know. To be continued as they say. Hey, thanks so much for joining us in real time. Thanks again to Linda Gartz. We will post her website, lindagartz.com, along with the podcast when it becomes available. A fascinating read. I think you'll enjoy it and learn something called Redlined. Thanks to the TCS crew, Trudy and Aurora, for working with us in the booth as usual, ML at headquarters. And don't forget, you can reach out via social media. Friend me on Facebook. Follow our producer, Trudy Hart, on radio, on Twitter at Radio Trudy. Follow me for the 24/7 conversation at AB Writes. Meantime, drive safe, play nice, dream big, and come back and see us, won't you? On the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show. Leave you with one from Nancy Wilson, the great interpreter of the American Songbook, who we lost at the end of last year. Here's a beauty, If I Had My Way. On the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show. Take care. Love y'all.
Taken for